Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. And where are we going today, Rabido?
Well, we sort of spent so much time in Nashville jolly and around, we decided it probably would be a good idea to spend at least one day actually sitting in the studio. So that's where we are today. But we have some special friends for you to meet, including a very, 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 very special friend and a very, very, very important man in the development of cuisine in these United States, namely
Jacques Pepin, the adorable, wonderful, lovable Jacques Pepin.
Award-winning absolutely everywhere, as you'll hear during the interview, and just the gentlest, kindest, most thoughtful man you can imagine, who just happens to churn out program after program after program on television.
He does. And books. I mean, this one is, it's sort of an essential book. But we had Essential Pepin before. This one's called Heart and Soul in the Kitchen.
And that's what this man has put into his whole lifetime in the culinary arts. And you should certainly add this one to your collection.
Jacques Pepin, your new book, Heart and Soul in the Kitchen, has so many aspects of it that elevate everything I've read about you. It's coordinated with your PBS television series, is it not?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, this is a new series that I have called Heart and Soul, and it's actually starting this Saturday at KQED, the PBS station in San Francisco, where I taped the series, where I tape all of my series for the last 25 years. And then it started nationally. It will start nationally on the 19th of September, from what I know. But the launching of the book is the 6th of October.
Well, you know, I have to mention right out, I mean, I know that you are an artist, but the illustrations for this book, they're really extraordinary.
Oh, well, thank you so much.
You have an innate talent. I can't remember if I ever asked you, did you have to pause before choosing cooking over making art?
No, I never really learned it art, except when I was at Columbia University, and I had time, and I took a class in drawing once. That's all I can remember. But you know, we were a whole bunch of friends painting together, so that's how it happened. And I've always done menus. Like at my house, I have 7 or 8 books, quite large book of menu going back 50 years. I've been married 50 years now, almost. And from the beginning, we started when we had people coming for dinner at the house. I write the menu, and people do, you know, some commentary and so forth. And very often I started illustrating those menus. So we have a lot of menu. I mean, it's like you know, a whole rundown of our life for the last 50 years. You know.
No, it's not true that Picasso once told you that if you didn't quit drawing, he would start cooking.
Yes.
You do wonderful chickens, by the way.
Oh, okay.
Not to mention pigs. I remember loving some other pigs you did.
Well, what was the other one, though?
The cow.
The one you showed me, I said it looked like a late Picasso.
Well, a lot of them do look a little Picasso-esque.
I would not compare myself to Picasso.
Well, no. The interesting thing about it, Jacques, is you must have been to a number of the museums where they have his work.
Yes.
And there's one somewhere in Spain. It might be Ronda or somewhere like that in Spain, where they have some of his late works. And the energy in them is absolutely amazing. And that's really the comparison I was making to this picture, which is in the book,
For me, Picasso may be the greatest painter of the 20th century.
Me too.
I mean, from the blue period to the pink period to the abstract cubism, I mean, he's so diversified, it's extraordinary. You know?
He's amazing, absolutely was amazing. Yeah, the only thing about Picasso is he was not very nice to women
Well, I am nice with women.
You're
I cook
very
for
nice.
Women. So.
Yes. You were really nice cooking favorite things for your wife. And of course, you had a whole series you did with your daughter, Claudine. And now we have a new member of your family and your granddaughter.
Right. So and she did several shows with me in that new series, and Claudine did as well. So we have a good time together. And hopefully I will do more show with my granddaughter to give her, you know, the lesson from my grandfather, teaching
right.
her how to cook. That could be nice.
Well, she seems interested, so that's a good start. I like the family photograph of you all with a little bottle and glass of wine in the woods. Very nice. There are a lot of things about you that people should know and probably don't because your cooking has a very chameleon-like flavor to it. It starts out, you're viewed as a French chef. But then you write that your mother didn't think you were very French in your cooking.
Right. And well, you know,
ahead.
I've been married 50 years to a woman born in New York City from a Puerto Rican mother and a Cuban father. So, and what has been going on in America in the last 30, 40 years have been extraordinary. And I love, you know, Chinese cooking and Japanese cooking and Mexican cooking. And I do all of this. I have never, I think, tried to be French in one way. By the same token, I've never tried not to be French. I don't really think too much in those terms, you know. I see ingredient at the market. I cook with friends. I feel like doing that, and I don't really care whether people call it, you know, Chinese-inspired or Japanese or whatever. I don't try to be a great purist of French cooking.
Now, do you know the famous English or French chef Raymond Blanc?
Oh, yeah, sure.
Now, he, of course, he's a little more outspoken than you are and says he single-handedly rescued British cuisine when he arrived in the 1970s.
Uh-huh.
You're much more modest than that.
Oh, no, I don't know about that. But.
Did he ever tell
you? No, never.
He never told you that?
No.
Oh, he told us that unavowedly. He's out speaking to the world about how he arrived and all of a sudden everything was fine.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, sometimes people dream a lot, you know, so I don't know.
Well, you know, looking back, I mean, I remember early on when we interviewed you, you said when you arrived in the United States, you couldn't even buy a fresh button mushroom in the supermarket.
That's true. I remember I live on 50th and 1st Avenue, Midtown, and I go to D'Agostino Brother, I think it was, the market, and ask where are the mushrooms, and they say, aisle 5. And that was canned mushroom. You had to go to a specialty store at the time to find just regular white button mushroom. I mean, there was no shallot, there was no leek. There was only one salad, that was iceberg, that's it. And none of the oriental vegetable and different type of herbs, forget it. So, yeah, it was another world. Yet, however, the meat was beautiful. I mean, the beef, lobster, lamb, all that type of stuff was amazingly beautiful for me and relatively inexpensive.
And you really, you are ingredient-driven in a massive way, so that it's not surprising that when you're at your place in Playa in Mexico, in the Yucatan, that you suddenly have a whole different range of ingredients and recipes.
Yes, of course. I mean, for me, cooking is, you know, the expression of climatic condition. You know, when you are in the south of France and you have beautiful tomato and basil and garlic and olive oil, you cook with it. If you go 30 miles up, you're in Italy. Basically, you cook with the same ingredients. So there has to be a great deal of similarity between the cuisine. More similarity between the cuisine of Provence, let's say, and Italy, than between the cuisine of Provence and Normandy, which is in the north of France. Uh-huh. You know, so it is not by country. It's more a question of climatic condition.
Now, why did you call this book from Heart and Soul in the Kitchen?
Yes, well, I don't know. I mean, it was the type of cuisine I wanted to be maybe. I'm always personal in my book, I think. I mean, I don't have an organization. I don't have a professional kitchen, that is a professional restaurant. I do my recipe. I write them down. I cook for my wife, write down the recipe on the yellow pad, and my assistant, Norma, retype it, and I do an introduction, and we have a recipe. And Norma has been working with me for 35 years. And that's it. So the team is me in the kitchen, and that's it. So it's not a big deal. So it's probably more personal than maybe some other chefs who have a restaurant. But on the other hand, you know, I'm not apologetic about it. That's the way it is. I would know how to do it differently. And that being said, you know, there is so many extraordinary books on the market now. I mean, it's an embarrassment of riches. You know,
right.
Now, you did have a partner in crime, shall we say, who became, together with you, became famous sort of jointly. And that's, of course, the beloved Julia.
Yes. Well, Julia, you know, I met Julia in 1960, so it's a long, long time ago. I was just in America a few months, and I knew Helen McCullough. She was the food editor of McCall, House Beautiful. And Helen spoke with James Beard every day on the telephone. So I met James Beard. And then Craig Claiborne came to do an article on the Pavilion, and I became friends with Craig Claiborne. And a couple of months later, then Helen told me there is that woman who sent me that manuscript to look. And that was manuscript of the Mastering the Art of French Cooking.
Uh-huh.
And she said, a woman is coming to New York, let's cook for her. And so I met the trinity of cooking, if you want, Julia and James Beard and Craig. Within like 6 months, I was here. And the food world was very, very, very small at that time. Julia was not known because she had never done a book, she had never done television before, and she did not write for a magazine or newspaper. She just actually came back from France, and we spoke French certainly more than English, or better, French was better than my English.
And you have a section, actually, in your book, this current book, called Cooking with Legends, and you have some wonderful stories, don't you? We were talking, Jacques, about this section in your book called Cooking with Legends.
Uh-huh.
And I read a book by somebody's grandson. I'm trying to remember who it was. What's her name? How to Cook a Wolf, remember?
Oh,
M.K.
Yeah,
Fisher.
M.K. Fisher. And it was called 1970 Provence. And I think it was her nephew or her grandson found notes from that period of time when a lot of you guys were in Provence at the same time cooking. And it revealed that there are all kinds of tensions that nobody ever reads about in talking about that period in group.
I wasn't on that group, no.
No,
I was in America working for Howard Johnson at the time.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about the Howard Johnson. There apparently is one left that everybody's trying to save. Do you know about that?
Yes. You mean working for Howard Johnson?
Yes, there is one existing Howard Johnson left somewhere.
Yes, I think his son is still alive, Howard B. Johnson.
Uh-huh.
And he has children as well.
But I think what Anne is saying, Jack, is there's actually one original Hojo's restaurant. But it's still
I don't think that they have anything to do with the Hojo company now.
Oh, okay.
It has changed hands several times. And I think there is one or two original Howard Johnson left in, there was one in Connecticut a few years ago. You can see Howard Johnson with the apostrophe S at the end, and that's the original one.
And what did you get from that experience?
Well, that experience was extraordinary for me. It was my American apprenticeship for 10 years. You know, I learned about marketing, about production, about the American eating habit, all the type of things which were totally different than my training. In fact, when I left Howard Johnson in 1970, I was there from 1960 to 1970, I opened a restaurant on Fifth Avenue called La Potagerie, which was large production. Then I opened the World Trade Center with Joe Baum. I set up the commissary. And at some point in the 80s, I was a consultant at the Russian Tea Room. But I'm saying that all of those jobs, I could never have done it without the training of Howard Johnson in terms of production.
That's very interesting. The other thing I want to note is that you are always full of surprises in your recipes. I had a large assortment of canned Burgundian snails, and I was using them in different ways, but it never occurred to me you have the most logical use of these snails. You bake them, or you put them in a baked potato.
Yes, well, potato and you know, if you have the potato and the snail butter and garlic and all that, that goes well with it. So, it was an idea. And sometimes, you know, especially with young chefs, which are crazy about creating something new all the time, creation can be just working with ordinary ingredients, but working a little more in depth. I mean, creation, for me, it would be the home cook, which has to cook every day for a family of six or eight under a certain budget and vary the menu and follow the season. That's a great deal of creativity there, you know. So creativity doesn't have to be using, you know, some unknown, you know, extraordinary ingredient with a different technique. It can be something else, too.
Now, I think I deserve a pat on the back. Because when we came back from one of our trips and we got back to Pittsburgh, we got home and it was kind of late and we didn't feel like going out for dinner. So I said, why don't we make a snail omelet? Now, I bet you never made a snail omelet.
Oh, yeah, it should be good.
it was absolutely terrific. Now, I have to say that a lot of the credit belonged to the man whose team foraged it somewhere in Burgundy.
But no, Jacques is well known for his love of eggs, and you put really good quality eggs to good use.
Yes, well, you know, ingredient, I mean, we are still, I mean, now the cook was really low on the social scale a number of years ago, and now we are genius, you know, I don't know what happened, but I mean, we still... You know, we're still mashed potato maker. That's what we are. So, I mean, you can't take it too seriously, you know.
Well, I do have one objection, is that you write this in this book, and that you make it all sound so simple to come up with these brilliant ideas, and to change things around with new ideas, and you're effortless with this.
Well, you know, I am in food. I've been in my food all my life. I am defined by food. I get inspired when I go to the market or look at the garden. And, you know, if you wanted to do a book on chicken, there's probably more than 20,000 different ways of making a chicken, whether it's a Thieboudienne in Africa or in China or whatever. So there is always a new twist and a new idea. And if you keep your eyes open, whoever you work with, you always learn something, you know. Maybe you learn what not to do, but you learn something.
if you were to indicate why our listeners should buy this book, even, I mean, buy it, even though they have all your other books, What is the one thing they'll get from this book that they won't get from any of the earlier books, of which there are many?
Because I'm 80 years old, I'm retiring, and I need money. They need to buy that book.
There you go. go straight to the Jacques Pepin Retirement Fund.
You know, there is, I always tell people, take a look at the book, open it, and if there is something which tempts you, you know, when you do a recipe, you should always do it exactly the way it's written down, at least to do justice to whoever wrote that recipe. But the second time you do it, I mean, if it turned out good and you're likely to do it a second time, you don't take, you test a faster look at the book. By the third time, you start changing it a little bit. You want more tomato or less tomato, or you want it thicker. And by the time you do it after a year, you have done it five or six times. You don't even know where it comes from, and it has become your recipe. You massage it, in a sense, to your own taste, you know, and that's the way it should be. You should have that type of progression. You shouldn't even know where it comes from.
Well, I believe it. For you, I would only wish it for me, to tell you the truth. But anyhow, it is a personal book, Jacques Pepin, and a lot of personal notes and thoughts on your friendship, on your cooking friends, on your fishermen friends, on your family, and lots of interesting, fascinating recipes. Good luck with your book. And don't go away anytime soon, okay?
Okay, thank you very much.
And remind us all about the award, the Julia Child Foundation Award, which you're getting in October.
Could you tell us what it is?
Just quickly tell us what that is.
Well, it is Julia Child create a legacy, in a sense, for herself starting in 1995, and she died in 2004 or 5. And which would be to give an award to someone who, in her opinion, has changed a little bit the face of cooking in America and teach cooking the way she thinks cooking should be taught. And I am the very lucky recipient of the first award, which is given at the Smithsonian Institute on the 22nd of October this year.
No, you've only changed American cooking just a little bit.
Thank you.
and this book is the latest installment, and I'm sure there'll be an installment to come. And listeners, if you prefer television to reading a book, you can tune in on your local PBS station. You have to find out when it starts. But you probably should make sure you get a copy of the book before you do that, so you can make notes in the margin.
Well, thank you.
Jacques Pepin, always a delight to have the chance to talk to you, sir. And we wish you many more years of cooking and teaching and writing.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much for having me, and happy cooking.
And to you, too. Thank you.
Bye.
And don't go away, because we'll be back after a short break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Next up, we have somebody who is, I think a teacher at heart, although she's a homesteader. And she's written 20 books on practicalities of how you should cook up your produce with what you've grown, what you've found. And this latest one takes you into other areas, so there's almost like a just general reference book. And we're talking about Andrea Chessman and her book, Kitchen Know-How, which tells you how to do just about everything.
From the backyard kitchen, the theme of all her books, I guess, is that there's somehow something to do with her backyard kitchen, which is a source of infinite wisdom.
It's actually field to table is the core
field
of it.
Field to table. But backyard, isn't backyard thing in the title of the book?
No.
Oh, okay.
Yes, it is. I'm sorry.
There you go.
It is the Backyard Homestead Book of Kitchen Know-How. I got it all off finally.
I'm going to be talking here to Andrea Chessman and her book, The Backyard Homestead, Kitchen Know-How, Field to Table Cooking Skills, covers so much information. And what she does by way of learning and grasping all of this information by doing this homesteading herself gives me my first question. When did you have time to write the book, Andrea?
Well, the writing of the book took 3 years.
Oh,
the
wow.
acquisition of skills, I think, has been my whole life.
Right. How long have you done this homesteading?
Well, I have had a garden since I was in college, or my first garden. It's a community garden, and I was hooked on it from then on. It seemed so magical that you put seeds in the ground, and then they grow. So I've always had a garden, and it's been bigger and smaller at various times, and we have been in our current home for a little over 20 years, and we added a lot of fruit to our garden and our yard. I don't raise animals, but I have been able to barter or buy from local producers who do raise animals. We only have 1 acre.
Yes, I read that, and that's... See, my mother did intensive gardening, so I'm used to... I mean, she used to put in... and we're sort of in the center. We're in, not in the center, but we're in an urban environment where we're in. And she used to put in 102 tomato plants at a season.
Yeah, no, she probably canned them after right?
Oh, yes, indeed. We did everything. Fresh tomato juice. But I think I don't agree with you that you just put a seed in the ground and something grows, because I never inherited whatever magic she had with growing things. Peter can tell you this, and I had my first garden when I was a child, but we also had an entire harvest when we lived in Washington, D.C., that we had for the whole season harvest as a first course, and I think it was, what, 4 green beans?
I think so, yeah. I didn't know what she'd been doing every day. I used to go out to work and come back, and I never really asked her what she did all day. And then one night she said, we have a surprise for dinner. And
I've been fighting woodchucks this year.
Oh,
so I actually haven't gotten a single bean. We're quite fond of them.
The weather itself, though, has just been so bad this year. I mean, I'm pleased to say we've gotten tomatoes, but the plants do not look very healthy. And I don't think we're having many more, but they've been tasty. But anyhow, let's get back to this book, because when you say kitchen know-how, you absolutely discuss everything. I mean, you can see that you've had years and years of right-in-the-field training to know all this stuff. I'm reading this. Never in my whole life did I imagine that you had to pick pears, because we have an Asian pear tree, and chill them in the refrigerator before you even should put them on the counter to finish ripening, or that you should actually pull them off the tree before they're really ripe.
Yeah, pears are tricky. Pears have probably, 5 minutes of perfect ripeness.
Oh.
And they're very challenging. I didn't grow every single fruit that's in the book. Some of it is learning from other people, but it didn't seem fair not to include everything. My brother lives in Alabama, so he was my source for handling citrus.
Oh, right. You wouldn't have that in Vermont.
No, never.
You have everything. You have charts, even though you don't raise animals. You have charts on the cutting of them. You have... Explain what is the organization of the book, because it's very straightforward.
The first part of the book deals with fresh foods and how to handle them, how to prepare them, to enjoy them immediately. And that includes vegetables, fruit, eggs, milk, and meats. And then the second part of the book is preservation. And that includes all of those foods and everything to do with drying, canning, freezing, storing in a cold cellar. If I missed anything? Oh, curing and making cheese.
Right.
And then the third part of the book is just some favorite family recipes.
I was surprised that favor, well, you're very straightforward about the equipment you need and saying the stuff that's necessary, but also the equipment that's not necessary. But one of the things you're madly in love with is your vacuum sealer, and we don't hardly ever use ours.
Well, it makes sense only if you're, I think it makes more sense for preserving meat. It doesn't make sense really for fruit. It's too aggressive.
Yeah.
It, when it sucks the air out, it smushes delicate fruit.
Well, not only that, but try it on bread. That was the first thing we tried. That was pretty funny. Peter said, look, it's
there's actually a learning curve. And it's not really, I mean, you can't have the heaviness of the food hanging over the counter, so you have to have it pushed way back on the counter in order to have it seal effectively, and there's just tricks, and it's a learning curve.
Yeah, well, we froze a vacuum-sealed a whole octopus once. That was pretty funny.
Yeah,
all the little suckers got flat, became not just two-dimensional objects.
It wasn't too happy, but turning bread into building material.
Yeah, that was
really good work.
Yeah, I think fish does pretty well and is pretty easy to use in a vacuum sealer. And one of my sons is a fisherman, loves to fish.
Yeah, you said one of your sons turned out to be a city guy, and the other one turned out to be a country guy.
Yeah, the country guy is a hunter-gatherer by nature,
uh-huh.
And we say he was born 100 years too late.
Aw.
Because he would love to just have a piece of land and live off of it.
Well, I mean, there's not much that you don't touch on in this book, is I guess that's what I want to convey. I don't think it's a book that you sit down at the beginning and read through. I think it's the kind of book where you look things up.
Well, I got a phone call from my son's best friend growing up, and he is now living on a piece of land with a group of friends, and I gave him a copy of the book and said, you know, I hope you can use it. And he said that he brought it home, and he said, you know, this mother of my friend, you know, gave me this book, and I don't know, it's probably pretty good, but I don't know. And he said after a week, they were processing all their meat birds, and they've been freezing from the garden and canning things, and he said that he keeps hearing people say, asking a question, and then someone say, just look it up in the book.
Yeah.
Look it up in the book, and it's all there.
Well, that's
and that's what I was hoping for.
Well, there's a quality of this book that, I mean, I shouldn't be surprised by it, except we get an awful lot of there's a lot of glossing around in a lot of these cookbooks, but you really are honest. There's a strain of honesty in here that is really inspiring. I mean, I like reading things like your strong opinions about pectin.
Opinion about, oh, pectin.
Pectin.
Yes, I do.
I'm jealous about that.
Well, I make a lot of jam, and I've been making jam for years. And when I started making jam, there were two brands of pectin available, Certo and Sure-Gel.
Oh, yeah, I know them well, yeah, from my mother.
And you had to use almost equal weights of fruit and sugar to activate the pectin, and
right.
You couldn't vary from their formula. And it made a fruit jam that was really,
sweet.
Really sweet.
Yes.
And then there was a brand that was developed called Pomona's Universal Pectin, and it could be used with any amount of sugar or honey or maple syrup, and people really embraced it, but it was a little bit fussy to use.
Uh-huh.
And now there are other low-sugar pectins available that are truly easy to use, and Ball Canning is my favorite brand for using it. Really convenient. But all of the people who learned how to make jam in the 80s are still using Pomona's Universal Pectin, even though it's a little bit more expensive and a lot fussier to use. And it's just people don't necessarily learn a new skill or a new technique once they've done it the old way.
Uh-huh.
So I like to keep fresh with new products.
Well, that's great. You know, when I'm leafing through your book, I realize how much we used to do that falls in these categories that we don't do anymore, like making sausage and stuffing the stuff by hand.
Right.
Yeah. We used to do that all the time as kids. My mother used to do that. And making yogurt, I don't do that anymore either. It takes so much time. So, as I told you earlier, that I had a friend and she did everything, absolutely everything. She lived outside of D.C. and every single thing was made by hand and grown on her property. If she grew grapes, she did this whole thing. And she had no time for anything else. She had no life.
Well, I think young people today are going back to wanting to do things for themselves, in part because they can't trust the products that they're buying, not always high quality, or they don't have, or they have chemicals in them that people don't want to ingest. And there is a tremendous satisfaction about producing your own food.
Oh, yeah, I agree. We even our poor crop from our garden, I think we got a kick out of picking the tomatoes and the raspberries and even the pears. Even though the pears have fruit fly, I just got around them.
Yeah, well, we're having some very cold nights here, which is taking care of the fruit fly problem, I am glad to say.
Yeah. You have surprises. People will, I think, find surprises because as much as anybody thinks he or she knows about food, in your book there's always more information. How many people have frozen eggs?
Right. Well, and there were surprises for me, too. I learned how to cure bacon in the process of working on this book, and I had never done any meat curing before, and I was amazed at how easy it was and how home-cured bacon tastes great, even though there's wonderful artisanal brands out there that the home-cured bacon was just the most flavorful. And then I've also, I think the one thing that I have in the book that's worth the price of the book is an overnight method for making steel-cut oats into oatmeal.
Oh, yeah.
So that I can have, and I do have steel-cut oatmeal for breakfast every single morning. And it's not, you know, a long cooking process.
Yeah, I think this has become very fashionable, actually. Most people do this the night before.
Right.
Yeah.
It's very easy to do. And one thing that's, you know, kind of, well, there's a lot of things that are being rediscovered, and I don't think they're brand new, but I think that we weren't aware of them, when I was growing up at least. And no-knead bread is another thing I have in the book.
Oh, yeah, I saw that you used that. It's funny because we're just plotting a program on wild yeast fermentation and that sort of thing, and talking about artisanal breads. And I'm not sure that the no-knead bread has really a fan base among the artisanal bread bakers. What do you think?
I don't think so, because among artisanal bread bakers, they're looking, maybe their goals are different, and they're weighing their ingredients and being precise. But what I was extremely proud of was that I make a great bread. I bake it almost daily. I use sourdough as the base, which gives it a lot of flavor. The dough rises overnight, and then I just bake it off the next day. And there's so little time involved that I actually can make bread every day and not have it be a big sinkhole of time.
Well, all I can say about this book is that it is a very valuable resource for a whole variety of people, not just for the person who's trying to live off the land. And that's, I think, probably what you intended, right?
Yes. Yes, I think we all live somewhere on the continuum of do-it-yourselfing.
That's a good
and
way
even
to put
if
it.
You buy everything at a farmer's market, you still need to deal with the food when you get it home.
Well, I mean, I think this is a really, really valuable resource book, and I have to congratulate you, Andrea, on producing
you.
It. All the while maintaining your household, freelance writing and editing, raising two kids. You've done it all.
Well, it's been an adventure.
Yes. Once again, it's Andrea Chessman, and the book is The Backyard Homestead Book of Kitchen Know-How, Field-to-Table Cooking Skills. And it's a handy reference we all should have. Thank you, Andrea. Yeah.
Well, thank you.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
And if our last track was all about sensible, old-fashioned advice from the backyard, our next interview is all about super new inventions for the kitchen.
Yeah, I've seen these ads pop up on my online New York Times subscription for this company called The Grommet with all these kind of unusual-looking gadgets. And I wanted to know what they were about, so I contacted them. And sure enough, we have Meredith Daugherty talking to us about the company, the mission, process, and selected culinary products. Well, I kept seeing this odd piece of, I don't know, it was very lovely actually, very graceful implement of some sort on an advertising space on my internet connection. And I think it was in the New York Times as well. And I wondered, whatever is the grommet? It wasn't the object. It was a company behind the object. So we now have two representatives from the grommet. We have Meredith Daugherty, and we have Michael. Last name Michael is what?
Lovett.
Lovett, that's right. I did have that.
That works very well with grommet. Grommet
and Lovett.
I love my grommet. I think of a grommet as being that mystery thing that was a thing you always developed in business school cases called a widget.
Yeah, it came out of that, like the circular tool you need to like put things together.
Is that what it is?
Yeah, that's our logo reflects that.
Or as my mother would say, it's a thingamajig.
Yeah, your mother.
Or a doofer.
Doofer she liked, yes.
No, that was your mother. Your mother liked doofers.
No, my mother did not use doofer. Okay. Your mother used
doofer. All right, well, she called them thingamabobs as well.
Yeah. Now, anyhow, let's get back to, this company was founded how long ago, and that was by Joanne Domeniconi. Domeniconi?
Yes. So the company was founded in 2008 by Jules Pieri and Joanne Domeniconi, really recognizing that there's a need for changing the way that products come to market. So some of the newest products are the most difficult to understand. They're innovative and they're different, and they need a little bit more product understanding. So we're using our media platform to be able to change the way that products come to market through really telling their story.
But they have to actually, they have the idea, they actually do the prototype themselves, and they actually are in production before they come to you, and it's primarily for marketing help?
Correct. They're coming looking for a wider audience, really being able to introduce their market-ready consumer product to a community of people that's highly engaged in learning about kind of undiscovered products. And some of them, you know, we do talk to in really early development stages, and those kind of have longer tails. But most of the products that we have are market-ready. They're still new, though.
Now, you have a wide range of products. It's not just culinary, although culinary is one of the what do you call it, the products?
Should we call it the target?
Yeah.
Absolutely. That's one of our main categories, our kitchen category, but we cover over 20 different categories. So everything from tech and gadgets to fitness and outdoor, home and garden, women, men's, kids, babies, pet, travel. So we're definitely covering a broad variety of categories.
Yeah, I was friendly with a patent attorney, and you can't even believe some of the ideas people come up with.
I know.
Yeah, my most favorite one was the self-lubricating diaper bin. I mean, just what everybody needs, right? Anyhow, so you, Meredith, are in charge of reviewing these products initially?
Yes. So I work with a team of grommet experts who, you know, we're reviewing every single week different types of products across all of those categories. And then we're going through hundreds of product ideas per week, and we choose up to 7 of them. And from there, what we're doing is we're testing and vetting all of the products on our platform. And then we use the testing and vetting results to drive kind of the content we create. So we're using that to kind of forge the human connection with the consumer by kind of revealing our testimonials of what we like about the product, how it works, what makes it unique and different. And only about 3% of the products we see actually make it on site. So you'll find that the site is highly curated, and we're doing a lot of that legwork of testing and vetting so that you're only seeing the best of the best.
And what is that website?
It is thegrommet.com.
Typically, who do you expect is going to go to thegrommet.com to look? Is it consumers, or is it distributors, or no, who is it?
So it's definitely consumers. So the way we work is every single day, weekday, we're revealing innovative new products that are handpicked by our team of discovery experts, and we're launching them, and we share them with our community of email subscribers. And then obviously we have other followers as well, whether it's the press and things of that nature.
Now, how do these potential clients find you?
So the curation process works in a couple of different ways. So a lot of it is, you know, we're following some of the crowdfunding platforms to see kind of what's new and innovative and making connections there. We do on our site have a spot called the Citizens Gallery where our community can actually suggest products to us that they like and they would like to see supported by the grommet. Independent makers can also submit their product to us for review. We get a lot of referrals from makers in their networks of other people coming up with new ideas. We frequently go to trade shows. So the ideas come from a lot of different places, and then we're looking kind of to find products that cross some of our core values. So our whole
What are some of your core values?
Yeah. So we follow the idea of what we call citizens commerce, which was trademarked by our CEO, Jules Pieri. And it's the philosophy of people vote with their dollars and they shop by their values. So anything from made in the USA to tech and innovation, crowdfunded products, sustainable living, social enterprises, handcrafted are all some of the values that we look for when we're scouting for product to launch on the grommet.
And how many people actually are employed by the grommet?
There's 55 people.
In the whole company?
In the whole company, yes.
And most of them are into research products?
So there's, right now we have a team of 4 discovery people who are looking out there looking for product.
Right. You have found a number of intriguing products. What are some of your favorite finds?
Yeah, so I would say in the kitchen category specifically, the things that do the best tend to be the problem-solving items. And you'll see a good portion of them in the kitchen category on our site, just because I think a lot of people are looking to make the process of cooking easier, and a lot of the entrepreneurs that we follow try to create products that kind of meet with that demand and come up with some amazing products. And then something like one of my favorites would have to be the Steak Champ, which is a thermometer for your meat. And it's a really kind of innovative product. A German-born inventor named Uli came up with this idea because most thermometers, they just take the temperature at one end at the point. This is really a high-precision, intelligent electronic that what it does, it takes the temperature of the meat at several points along the probe, and then it uses LED lights to flash how well the steak is done. So if it's rare, medium rare, it will flash kind of different to let you know so you can take it off. And the nice thing about it, too, is it works on the grill and your oven or on the stovetop with even duck, fish, and other game as well.
And this is obviously a big seller, you said.
It is. It's really popular.
Do you take a percentage of for marketing or a percentage of how do you work that for your profits?
So we function a lot like an e-commerce platform. That's what we are at our core, and so we kind of that's where it is. I mean, the marketing piece is just our business. I mean, that's okay. What we're doing, and every day telling a story, creating a video, hosting a live conversation with the maker. That is the nature of our business. So there's really no marketing fee per se with every maker. Our job in discovering these products and telling them about it, that's the marketing piece. But we operate like any sort of e-commerce platform that you'd find.
You mean with a percentage or a fee?
Yeah, so it's a percentage of sales, so it's, you know, off of a wholesale margin relationship.
How about other interesting things you've discovered?
Yeah, so our kitchen multi-tools always tend to be good sellers for us, and people really kind of get interested in them. And one that's really great is TNK, which is a really innovative kitchenware company that's based in the Netherlands. And they're all about kind of creating tools that help you cook more efficiently with fewer utensils and then less mess. So they have this line called the Barracuda and the Stingray, and the Barracuda is a combination of a strainer, a spatula, tongs, and a fork, so that you only have to really use one utensil if you're sauteing something or if you need to drain kind of excess liquid off. And then the Stingray is a combination of tongs, a fork, and a spatula that lets you kind of grab and flip things with precision, and they have a model that's just made for kind of stovetop cooking, and then also something for the barbecue.
Yeah, those were the ones. Those were the ones I found hardest to envision. I don't know. They look kind of awkward. I mean, they're with all these things attached to. So you get to hold one thing, but it has all these different parts on it.
You do, and that's sort of, I think, where our content comes in, that we're really, you know, it looks a little bit confusing when you see just a photograph of it, but through the content that we're creating, if you watch some of the maker stories that we produce for every single launch, you'll be able to see kind of that functionality really demonstrated, and I think that's when kind of the story of the product and the product education really comes to life.
Okay, and then you're also proud of Bees Wrap. What is that?
Yeah, so it's an all-natural storage solution for food. So it's taking the place of kind of your Saran Wrap in traditional sandwich bag. And it's based around the premise of using organic cotton, beeswax, and jojoba oil as an alternative for wrapping up your food. So think breads, fruits and veggies, and things of that nature. And it uses kind of the warmth of your hands to really mold to the product so that beeswax kind of with your hands touching it will mold to the product so you can use it to wrap things up. And we do have a community of people that really kind of rallies around made in the U.S., sustainable living, and supporting kind of female entrepreneurs as well. And that definitely crossed off a lot of those values.
Now, you've got a couple of products that sound like they're almost the same, the Burger Master Tray and the Shape and Store Freezer Storage Container. Tell us about those guys.
Yeah, so Shape and Store is the company that creates the Burger Master, and they're all about kind of creating storage solutions. So the Burger Master is basically the silicone solution where you can take your ground meat and divide it into the Burger Master. It's kind of like a burger press, but you can make multiple burgers at once. And it's, you know, can be not only used for hamburger to store that and make individual patties and take it out and put it right on the grill, but you can make soup. You can put soups in there to have kind of single-serve soup. And that way, you know, if you're somebody who just wants to make one burger, but you like to kind of make your own and save it for later, you can just pop it right into the freezer. And when you want to make the rest, you can just take it out and put it right on the grill or make your soup or do what else you need to do.
Okay, now, how is that different than the Shape and Store? That's what I was getting a little confused.
Shape and Store is the brand, and the Burger Master.
Oh, okay, I've got it, okay. So it's really the same. It's really just one product.
Yes.
Oh, okay. Well, that helps me a lot. I was thinking I was really dumb.
Does your team ever think of an idea of something that's missing, and then look for somebody to design it?
We haven't really come across that, mainly because the people that we're working with are so far ahead of us in creating these products, and we're kind of at times just kind of blown away by what they come up with. And maybe there's been a case or two where we think to ourselves, oh, wouldn't it be great if this happens, and then you know, 2 weeks later, there it is on the Citizens Gallery or at a trade show or being funded on Kickstarter. So it's almost like we're just hurrying to keep pace with the innovation of makers, and that's kind of the beauty of, you know, what we're involved in the maker movement is Grommet is just a piece of this huge machine, hopefully creating the next industrial revolution where you see people 3D printing and laser cutting their own products, and at first we're almost fans of these, you know, we're just kind of rooting for them and wanting to see what happens, and then we think, oh, wait, well, let's put it on our site too. And so we get to kind of root for them for the whole process, because not only are they amazing products and amazing stories, but then we get to promote them ourselves and we get to tell those stories, and that's where we really have the fun.
Well, I think that there's certainly a niche for business.
Well, we should connect you up with them. You always have lots of ideas about what doesn't exist yet.
Who?
You.
Me? Oh, yeah.
You're
right.
You're always inventing things in your head, and 10 years later, somebody reinvents them.
Well.
And you have my email, so anytime you
right.
Got it. There you go. Sure.
We're always open to, you know, new ideas and, you know, people kind of submitting products to us for review, for sure.
That's for sure.
Well, thank you so much
yeah. for talking to us, and thank you, Mike, for all that you went through, jumping through hoops for all this.
And it's not the widgets. It's not
well worth it.
Listeners, it's not the widget, it's the Grommet. So there you
That's
go.
That's correct. TheGrommet.com, where you can discover what's next.
Thanks, both of you.
Thank you.
And who knows where we'll be next week? Who knows where you'll be next week? Except we hope that we'll convene in the same place at the same time for yet another program on the Menu Radio. And in the meantime,
bye-bye.